Welcome to Writers' Voices with Monica and Carolyn. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and with me is my wonderful mother and co-host, Carolyn Kilborn.
And a beautiful day it is.
This is the kind of day in the middle of July that we're eternally grateful for.
This is one of those 5 days in Iowa that's perfect.
On the way over here, we have a special guest with us in the studio today. In addition to our on-air guest, we have an off-the-air guest.
Yes, my granddaughter.
Leanne Herr from Houston, all the way here from Houston, Texas. Hi, Leanne. So on the way over here, Leanne asked me if I like living in Iowa, and I said I like living in Fairfield, and in Iowa I like about half the time.
Yeah.
The half,
yeah,
that's not
about right.
Too hot or too cold.
Yeah. Yeah, there are places that are, you know, like this all the time, I guess, but it's not Iowa. I like Iowa.
Yeah.
Something about it. Of course, I'm an Iowa native, you know, completely.
That's true. Although you've lived on
lived
both
other
coasts.
Places, but I was born and raised in Iowa. Yeah,
yeah. You've been on both coasts.
Yeah, right.
Well, our guest today is my good friend and fellow vacationer of last week,
mm-hmm.
Hillary Kurtz.
Hi again.
Welcome, Hillary. Yeah, this is your third time on our show?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I guess you can be considered a guest, too, today.
That's true. We're doing something a little different today.
Yes, because these ladies just attended the University of Iowa Writers' Workshop last week, and they have wonderful things to tell us about that, inspiring other people to try that and their experiences and the people they met. And so let's start out with how does one sign up for this, Monica?
I did it by looking online. And I don't remember right off the top of my head what the website is, but if you Google Iowa Summer Writing Festival,
mm-hmm.
you'll get there.
Or specifically writinguniversity.org.
Okay. Oh, that's
will
right.
take
yes.
you to everything around the university in writing and the arts, and will link you to the Summer Writing Festival.
Writinguniversity.org.
Of course, University of Iowa has long been famous for their writing programs. I mean, you know, for a long, long time. Is there more than one? There's more than one workshop a year?
Well, the University of Iowa is most famous for the Masters of Fine Arts program, which is called the Writing Workshop. And what we attended is actually called the Summer Writing Festival.
Ah.
Yeah. And, however, there are workshops as part of that festival. So the MFA program is a 2-year program, which is very difficult to get into and very prestigious, and has had people like Flannery O'Connor and Kurt Vonnegut and some very substantial authors come out of that program. And most of the instructors at the Summer Writing Festival are graduates of the Writers' Workshop, don't you think?
I wasn't aware that, I don't know,
you don't know
what the percentage is, but a lot of them have roots with this and, you know, fond memories and loyalty to the festival. And this is the 20th year of the festival. And what amazes me about this is it's not just a one-time, one-week shot. It is a 2-month program of weeks and weekends. And it is such an extensive festival that I found out the administrator, Amy Margolis, works on this full time round the year.
And she has a couple of staff members, too, that I don't know if they're
That's
year
right.
round or
Carol,
not.
That's right. Carol, who introduces the Elevenses.
Right.
And there was somebody else.
Jean, I think.
She has to coordinate all the staff and everything and
right.
to get ready.
Right. There's a lot to it because there's 6 week long sessions, and I'm not about that many weekends also, and each of them has approximately a dozen workshops, and
ranging from poetry to fiction to nonfiction,
and even screenwriting. There's mm-hmm. there were a couple, or script plays. There was, I don't know if there was screenwriting this time, but there were plays, and the number of students in each session was 8 to 12. I think the maximum is 12.
Oh, great.
In each workshop.
Yeah, so we calculated about 120 in our whole
week. But then you multiply that by 6 weeks throughout the summer.
But a small group like that is conducive to, you know, really getting to know one another and so forth.
That's true. I made some friends.
Yeah,
there.
Great. Mm-hmm. Hopefully made some interviews.
That's true, too.
And I already got class pictures and emails of Mary's bird pictures. and it was such a contrast to that first day when we were all sitting down in a, somewhat stark classroom setting, very bare. And we're all just anticipating, and we're being quiet, and we're not hardly talking to each other. And, by the end of the week, we were all at a banquet celebrating and hugging and this and that, and that's what goes on.
Yeah. The one thing, you don't get an awful lot of opportunity to meet people in classes other than your own. I mean, there are a couple of whole group events, the first evening, the orientation, and then the second evening. We had a wine and cheese reception in the old Capitol building, which was really lovely.
Cool, cool place to visit. Oh, gosh, yes.
And,
beautiful place.
At the Elevenses, which we'll talk about in a little bit, everyone was allowed to go to that, but not everybody did attend that. About half the group would attend that. But I thought there'd be a little more kind of whole group.
But what I noticed what I noticed about the difference in being in more of an academic setting was that everyone was very serious and concentrated. I mean, this is a group of writers of all stripes, and as Amy introduced us all that first night, welcome to your tribe, and yet everyone is, actively pursuing that creative process in their brain, too. And, they're wanting to absorb everything they can from their classroom environment and from their writing time.
And I assume that there were different sections. For instance, you mentioned screenwriting, poetry. Okay, which one were you girls in?
Well, I was in a class called Novel Solutions, which was essentially about structure and technique in novel writing. So that was a fiction class. And the instructor was Wayne Johnson, who is going to be a guest on our show at some future date. I think we might wait till his next book comes out in October. And he's published 4 novels under his own name and 8 more under pen names.
Let's stop here a second. Why do authors use pen names?
Well, he had some interesting stories about that. He wouldn't actually tell us what his pen names were. And I really probed, I'll tell you. I was very, very curious, especially after he told us this one story about, I think, the first book he published under this one pen name. He's used 2 different ones. Got a lot of attention and some awards and was actually selected for Oprah's book club.
Wow.
And he was going to hire a friend to be the author on Oprah and was advised by his attorneys that he couldn't do that. And he ended up, they ended up calling Oprah and saying that he would come on, but he was the wrong gender.
Oh, so he's using a female pen name.
Yes.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
So she didn't want it as a book written by a man.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
And this was in the era before, who's the man who's referred to so much?
James Frey.
Frey.
James Frey for
the Oprah debacle.
He was the one who she really took under her wing and had on her show for his book, A Million Little Pieces, which was purportedly about his experiences reaching the deep as an alcoholic, a drug addict, reaching bottom, and then going to rehab. And it's an unusually written book. The style is different than most books. It doesn't use normal punctuation and quotes and things like that. So it moves very quickly. And it came out that some of the episodes of his life that he wrote about didn't actually happen.
Ah, fiction.
In the reverse, we will, as we said, talk about the Elevenses, which took place at 11 a.m. every morning, Monday through Friday. One of the speakers was Hope Edelman, and she addressed the law and ethics of writing about real people. And
of course,
this was
yeah.
a fascinating topic, very
Indeed.
Engaging.
What are some of the things that they have you have to be careful of? You have to get permission from someone, of course, if you're going to write about them.
Well, not necessarily. It depends on who they are, whether they're a public person. You actually don't have to get permission to write about people, but you have to be sure what you're writing is true.
Otherwise, it can be slanderous.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah, and by the way, just to get a jump on that, you can go to writinguniversity.org, and many of these Elevens' talks are archived, and I've noticed that Hope's is on there, so you can listen to the full hour.
They're available as podcasts, yeah.
Oh, good.
Yeah, and also, you don't have to be attending the writing festival to attend the Elevens'. It's open to the
yeah,
public.
Yeah, big bonus.
Yeah.
Yes.
And some of the, well, the let's go through the five speakers that
sure.
were there when,
good
we,
idea.
When we were there.
Do you have the list?
The first one was Vince Gotera, who mm-hmm. is a poet, and he was teaching poetry. He is going to come to Fairfield.
And he's very entertaining. We totally recommend you tune in to him.
Yeah. And he was speaking on how not to get published in literary magazines because he's the editor-in-chief of the North American Review, which is a fairly well-known literary magazine. And so he was talking about the mistakes that writers make that take them out of
and very hysterically funny mistakes.
Yeah.
I mean, the least of which is not including your self-addressed envelope with the stamp on it. Didn't he talk
for your
about
rejection notice?
One guy who sent a letter a day for
oh, yeah.
a year or more. And
or, no, he sent a poem a day.
A
I mean, he was
day.
Trying to get poetry published, and he sent, like, just one after another, which is really not a good
right.
move.
So there are rules, you know, there are rules of decorum and style and such. And, you know, most people get alerted to those if they read the how-to books, but when you're listening to somebody talk about the actual experiences of how they are trying to be kind as an editor and they have to move quickly and, you know,
yeah.
and he started the session by asking what people's impressions are of editors. And the stereotype is, you know, the harried editor.
Overworked, underpaid.
Overworked, underpaid. What else did you say? Young. Somebody said young.
Yeah.
Which is not exactly the case, but they do have to quickly move through. I mean, Vince, I think, said he got some thousands a month of entries. And they get to a
wow.
point where they're just really scanning. They're like
I'm sure.
flipping through the pages.
Yeah,
that's where that first hook.
Not to scare
is
you or anything.
Yeah, right.
And also the rule about starting. Don't start at the top. Don't start by trying to publish in the very
in the Paris Review or Story or one of the most prestigious ones. Yeah,
and there are
work your way
of
up.
Other literary. We know we're talking about literary magazines
right.
now.
Right. Yeah, and yeah, there's plenty of small ones, and the thing is that if you believe that writing is a craft that you will improve as you progress, as you keep writing, by starting at the top, trying to get published in one of these most prestigious ones first, you're probably not sending your best work to them, and so the best work that you're going to be capable of doing.
Uh-huh.
And so you may be blowing your opportunity of being noticed later.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's very likely you'll be rejected and get discouraged, whereas if you start at the bottom and work your way up.
Okay, could this happen if as you say, you send it to a top one immediately and then they note that it's not the quality they want? Would that prejudice them for future submissions?
Probably not
maybe.
One or two, but if you sent 10 before you were ready, they might not look at the 11.
It's very systematic. They do log everyone in.
Mm-hmm.
They index
mm-hmm.
names and.
Okay, well, that's important to know. You know,
yeah.
That's why it is. I think would say start yeah. small.
But in some cases, they will say, you know, we liked it, but it's not quite up to speed yet, or it's not quite what we like. Try again. And in which case, he emphasized, you should definitely.
Try again.
Immediately.
Immediately.
Yeah. Or if you get a story, you send in a story and it's rejected, but said, you know, if you were to change this and this, we might consider it. Make the changes and send it in.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I suppose some writers are so egotistical that they think, all right, it's the way it is, the way it is. They don't want it okay.
Oh, absolutely. Sure.
Some do, but I think a lot of writers are really humbled and sometimes stopped, you know, in fear of being rejected. I mean, there are a lot of anecdotes about, you know, getting rejected. And
I'm sure.
And, you know, like anything that you have to stumble and try, you know, the emphasis that Vince Gotero was giving at least is, you know, try again. You should expect 82 rejections, you know.
Didn't he say that was the average before first publication?
I believe so.
Yeah.
And a person might get discouraged with that many rejections,
so
right?
So just be sure you don't quit on number 81.
Uh-huh.
Now, I wanted to just interject that it's curious for me that I have not had the drive to get published, probably because there's no body of work that I have, you know, labored on for years, and because I own a newspaper and I can self-publish. But, you know, a lot of people do consider that the benchmark. And for me, I've been more of an experiential writer. If I have a good experience with it and I expand my sense of what that experience is in my life, the enrichment in my life, then it is secondary to me.
Whether it's published or publishable.
Whether to get published. And yeah. I can't say I compared notes with people, but Monica, I know in your class, because it was a novel writing class, I'd expect...
Nobody wants to spend 3 years writing and perfecting a novel and then stick it in a drawer.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Although we did talk to that one lady at dinner that one night, Kate, who said that she believed that everybody should, that you had to write two novels that you stuck in a drawer before you were mm-hmm. could start sending one out.
Mm-hmm. But, so what class were you in then?
20 Dances Towards Flapping Your Wings Again, a generative workshop for writers.
And interesting title.
Yes, it was. And Karen Subach's in her 20th year of teaching the class, or,
wow.
You know, in the program. She was versed in 5 languages. She was able to recite poetry just on the tip of her tongue.
In multiple languages,
and was able to correlate a poem with whatever anyone else was writing. So she was truly miraculous.
I should say.
As a person and a human being. And
as a teacher, for sure.
Teacher, absolutely.
And coincidentally, married to my teacher.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Birds of a feather.
Yeah.
So if this program gets archived, we want to say hello to all our fellow writers and teachers in the program.
Definitely. Yeah, we'll have to send a link out to everyone once it gets on the archives. You're listening to KRUULP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. This is Writers' Voices with Monica and Carolyn on July 20th, if you're listening live.
And the two writers today are Monica Hadley and Hillary Kurtz, because they just attended a festival at the University of Iowa Writers' Festival and had a lot of fun.
Mm-hmm. And we had a choice of a T-shirt or...
Been there, done that, got the T-shirt, huh?
I got the canvas bag. There it is.
You know, one thing that was kind of a surprise up there was how good the food was at the events that they, you know, they served us dinner 3 nights and
I know.
The rest of the time we were on our own. But
I wonder if they
good.
Had a cooking school there. Oh. Remember they used to have the Memorial
know.
Union, a very good restaurant, the Stateroom or something like
oh,
that?
Oh, yeah.
But there was like some sublime vegetarian food and, yeah. Chicken with lentil curry and
all
salmon and ginger
things.
And lemon sauce.
Oh, wow. Making me hungry.
Well, back to the Elevenses, the lecture series that was mm-hmm. 1 hour a day. On Tuesday, the lecturer was David Payne, who is a novelist, and his class that he was teaching there that week was advanced novel. And he talked about third-person omniscient point of view. One thing that I found really interesting is he said that the reason that writing teachers focus so much on point of view mm-hmm. is because it can be taught. So much mm-hmm. about writing cannot be taught.
Uh-huh.
You can't teach creative flow. You can't teach motivation and desire, basically. But you can teach the technical aspects, and point of view is one that you really can focus on.
Character development might be another.
Yeah, and plotting.
And plotting,
and,
yeah.
Omniscient point of view is a third-person point of view. He said most people are naturally write in either first or third person. First, of course, is
I did this, yeah.
Yeah, and third person is he, she, they. But there's various versions of third person that, like a third-person omniscient, you can get in the head of any of the characters in the story. Whereas a third person limited, you're only in one person's head.
Ah.
Or at least during in a given chapter, you're only in one person's head. You can do third person limited alternating, but also with third person limited, anything that's told has to come through a character's perceptions. Whereas with third person omniscient, the author can actually interject authorial, what's called authorial interjection, mm-hmm. and can tell the reader things that none of the characters know, or that the characters in that scene don't know.
Aha. Uh-huh.
That's very well described, Monica. Yeah. And he used, there were two novels that he used, one, Anna Karenina, he used extensively to show omniscient, and Empire Falls by Richard Rousseau, and I believe it won a Pulitzer.
Right.
If you pick up that book and go to the beginning of it, you'll get a sense of what omniscient.
Yeah, the thing about using omniscient is, or at least this is the sort of the rule. One thing that my instructor said a lot was that you have to learn all these rules, but then you can forget them once you know them well enough. You don't have to think about it all while you're writing. It's kind of like learning a new dance step, like if you're learning swing dancing. Mm-hmm. At first it seems overwhelming about all these things you have to remember about where your feet go, where your hands go, what your hips do, this, that.
Right.
Same with writing, particularly with fiction. You're supposed to remember point of view and plot strands and structure and all these things.
That would be interesting to find out what the history of writing is, because, I mean, that idea infers that there was writing before there were rules. And that, you know, humans as writers created these from their sense of life.
Yeah.
And then somebody started to analyze.
Well, the rules are basically intended to help you keep the reader engaged in the story. If you break these rules, you are taking a risk of losing your reader.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you don't necessarily lose your reader. If you're Virginia Woolf, you get to break all the rules. But for most of us, frankly, you know, we use some Virginia Woolf things in as examples that I would have been gone. I would never have read it.
Do you
willingly.
Do you ever change point of view in a piece?
Certainly. Back to using omniscient. If you're going to use omniscient, which means you can change point of view frequently, scene to scene, even within a scene, if you do it gracefully,
if your transition is smooth.
But you have to start out, your first line has to be from a distant perspective, an omniscient perspective. And Anna Karenina is the example that is used. It has a very famous first line, which I'm not going to quote exactly, mm-hmm. but something to the effect that all happy families are alike, and all unhappy families are unhappy in their own way, or something like that. So that is obviously not coming from a character's perception. That's coming from above the scene. Mm-hmm. And then the author, Tolstoy, very quickly narrows down into a specific family, and then from there to a specific person in that family. So he's coming from a wide perception, an authorial perspective, down till he's in the character's head. Then he can pull back whenever he wants. The rule is, if you don't start there, if you start inside a character's head, you cannot later come in with that broader perception.
So there's some rules about that. All right.
Yeah.
I see.
Yeah, that's very potent, because that first phrase is a setup.
Exactly.
Whether or not you personally believe it, it dictates the idea of the entire novel.
Yep. Yep. One other thing that David Payne said that I liked was that he said that, like I mentioned earlier, that most people are naturally writing either first or third, but as you grow, you must attempt the other. If you want to grow as a writer. And the classical third-person omniscience is associated with 19th century authors. It was very commonly used in the 19th century. It fell out of favor in the 20th century. We became much more accustomed to a closer perspective, more first person, which a first person and a close third provides less psychic distance between the reader and the story.
Mm-hmm.
And so those became more popular, but there has been a resurgence of the use of that omniscient third. And the examples like Empire Falls, mm-hmm. and several other recent Pulitzer Prize winners, I think The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay by Michael Chabon, whose younger brother we met the first evening. He was a student at the festival. And The Known World by Edward Jones. So all three of those are using this type of point of view.
Okay. We're talking with Monica Hadley. You recognize her voice, of course, and maybe you recognize Hillary Kurtz, and she's been on our program before. And they attended the Writers Festival at the University of Iowa last week. And it was from Monday through Friday?
Started Sunday night.
Oh, okay.
Sunday night through Friday evening.
And you had an orientation first.
Right, right.
That was to just introduce you to the whole process?
And then we had an initial class meeting Sunday evening, too. It was where, for the workshops, which means some of these classes were designed as workshops where people brought pre-existing work that was going to be critiqued by the class.
Uh-huh.
And for those type of things, the Sunday evening meeting is necessary for handing out everybody's work so that you get a chance to start reading your classmates' work.
So did you have something to take?
Yes, I did.
And how did it fare?
That was kind of interesting. My piece, it was a novel class, and we were limited to 18 pages, and mine was the first one that got critiqued on Monday, and it was the only one on Monday. And the instructor did almost all the critiquing of that one because the class hadn't really learned enough yet
Didn't know how to critique yet.
And he made the point there that by the end of the week, the class would be doing much more of the critiquing, which was true. And it was tricky for me. I got a lot of compliments from my classmates, particularly a few compliments from the instructor, but a lot of criticism, and mostly on point of view issues.
His specialty.
And the other thing that I had a tendency to do was to write scenes that really drew people into the scene, and then I would stop and summarize the end of it instead of staying in the dramatic present. This is something that I really learned in this class, is that you can't have a book that's written entirely in the dramatic present, mm-hmm. but you have to have some exposition,
mm-hmm.
some summarization. But the more you can stay in the present, the more engaged the reader remains. And
well, I know if you change point of view frequently, it confuses the reader.
Right.
And
right.
Once you've confused them, you've lost them. Because what's the point of this? I'm not going to finish this book.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. He talked about rendering versus reporting. You know, the type, when you talk about a story in a newspaper, it isn't really a story, it's a report.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And when you want to write a story, you have to render a world alive so that as you read, you care about the choices that the characters have to make. And to be powerful, that dream has to be vivid and continuous. There can't be a lot of interruptions to that dream world, essentially. So a repeatedly interrupted flow of action has a lot less impact than something that continues.
Now, stop a minute. Does that mean unnecessary details?
No. Actually, detail helps make the scene vivid. It helps make the reader feel present. if it's done well. What happens a lot of times is that writers, you want to use vivid detail and you want to use metaphor because it can really draw a reader in. But if you use a mixed metaphor where a reader has to stop and think, how do those two things relate?
Go together.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
that pulls them out.
Mm-hmm.
But I think in my writing, the concrete details were the strength, the description. Setting is actually is a character in your story.
Yeah, I can see that.
Mm-hmm. It can be used. Setting can be used to develop characters. It can be used to tell. Describing the setting is part of telling the story.
That's true. Yeah. I mean, a character at a bar, and put the same character at the beach.
That's right.
Yeah,
two different characters. Yeah,
yeah. You're saying something, or you're showing something
showing,
very different.
Yeah, that's
now, one of the other interesting things was that, as writers, we always hear this cliche.
Which one?
The one that says "show, don't tell."
Yeah, show, don't tell.
Show, don't tell. Well,
and if you're young, you can show and tell.
Actually, you have to show and tell.
It is
storytelling. It's not story showing.
That's true.
Yeah. Now, you can't tell everything because then it would be boring. But it is okay to tell some things, to summarize some things, because otherwise it's boring. You know, you need a good mix of both.
And that's where that you separate the men from the boys. Good writers from the not so good writers.
Yeah.
And is there any writing on earth that isn't in some way telling a story? I mean, even a short newspaper report, I could argue.
Well, absolutely. Yeah.
Evokes some sequence and images and place, time. And, you know, I'm sort of waxing poetic here, but
what would
the world be without...
Yeah, evokes an opinion.
The written language.
Opinion or appreciation of the piece.
And,
you know, Hillary, a little bit ago you were talking about why you weren't driven to publish because of the experience of writing and what that does for you. What did This Week in Iowa City do for that your experience of writing?
I'd say on the top of the list it was... the difference between agonizing over whether or not I am a writer, whether or not I am writing, and suddenly being in this privileged situation where I was able to write every day. And so I felt that I came out with more of a sense of self-dignity because I know writing is an important aspect in my life. I spend a lot of time thinking about writing and writers and pieces of writing and their effect on me and their effect on society. And I've also since then just continued to develop my ideas about how writing opens us up psychologically and how it can be used by anyone at any age. In fact, when I look back on my early days, young writers, you know, the fruit that was coming out of their minds at that time, and then if you take that and develop that over the years, and if you haven't developed it so much, then you can go back at any point and work with it. And my teacher used a exercise approach, and there are a lot of teachers who do. Who is it?
Writing Down the Bones.
Writing Down the
Bones.
Stanley
Goldberg?
Goldberg.
Goldberg, yeah.
Who popularized this technique. And this is really where I had been coming from for the last 10, 20 years. you know, while I was raising children and just while I've been in Fairfield, I would go to these writing groups and we would get writing exercises. And this time it was coupled with a teacher's expertise about all these different areas, in her case, more about poetry. So we got to play with things like anapas and didactyls, which, you know, everyone thought were dinosaurs.
I was going to say. And they actually are.
They're actually different metered rhymes, you know, based on a repetitive accent.
Mm-hmm. Do you have an example?
Oh, I didn't bring my own anapost example, but it's similar to the beat of a drum.
Okay.
Or any musical instrument that has
kind of like,
if you study language, I guess you know the words to describe the soft accent and the hard accent. Mm-hmm. And actually, Karen started talking about the clash in Europe and how one language won out over the other. But that poetry started with these sort of, in this part of Europe, war marches and almost song, repetitive song, and was developed. At least she was talking about, you know, European Anglo-Saxon language. But I'm getting off the track here. I don't know if there is a track.
We're just touching a lot of bases.
Yeah.
And you're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Carolyn on KRUULP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. And we're discussing the University of Iowa Summer Writing Festival experiences from last week
with
Hillary Kurtz.
There is something that I do remember. You know, when I was going to college and studying literature, during that era in the early 70s, there was an idea of writers as being tortured and, you know, self-torture. And they were spending time, you know, being drunk or
stereotype.
Hanging out in dark corners.
The Hemingway stereotype.
Yeah. And when I was that young, that image really took hold. I think it took hold of all of us. And, of course, it helped romanticize us. But I think it did damage, because when I looked at the group that was attending the festival and the wide range of people who are writers who didn't have to layer on some false idea of themselves based on that past image, it was a healthy experience for me, and it actually did turn the whole thing around for me.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
So you don't have to have angst to be a writer.
No, I mean, you can use your angst, but, you know, maybe, who knows, maybe it was just an enclave of a certain intense personality, or maybe there's an argument that only the finest writing happens out of, you know, the depths of hell, but...
the dark night of the soul.
The fact that there's so much writing abounding now in the general populace, so many kinds of people from different levels of society writing, from every field even writing.
Were there people from all of the United States here?
That was the interesting thing. We were practically the only Iowans there. You know, there were few people from Iowa.
There were about four of us from Fairfield, and we couldn't find anyone from California.
Oh.
We found a lot of people from the East and
Midwest,
Illinois, South and North,
Illinois, Missouri, Minnesota, Wisconsin,
Florida,
Pennsylvania,
Colorado,
right.
Do you think they were as pleased with the presentations as you all were?
Oh, definitely.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's good.
I expected to have more Iowans there, but it really draws a broad range of people. So we were kind of the hometown people. We knew where things were in Iowa City and where to go and what to do.
Yeah, right.
And there are writing festivals, you know, that are just as prestigious on the West Coast and the Mountain States and the East Coast.
Yeah.
I looked up the Bread Loaf Conference in Vermont, but that you have to enter.
Oh, you have to be.
Yeah.
You have to apply.
Submit something,
you
and
do. You have to get accepted. And but there are public readings, so you could just hang out there if you wanted to.
One of the differences between this, the U of I Writing Festival, and a lot of writing conferences that are held is that at the writing conferences, the focus is more on being a writer, and at this, the focus is more on writing. And by that, I mean that the conferences, they have agents and editors speaking, and they talk about more, there's more focus on marketing and that whole side of it, whereas this really was focused on perfecting the craft of writing.
Did they get into the idea of, you know, rewrites and publishing and editors and marketing? I mean, it's not, you just don't write it. It's this whole other thing, too.
I don't think the emphasis is on marketing as much as crafting.
Right. But there was some, like the last day we had half an hour on some of the business side of it. And he would have done more if we'd wanted it. But
in your class.
In our class, yes. And, of course, Vince Gotera's talk was about being accepted in literary magazines. He was, and Hope Edelman's was a lot about the kind of the legalities that you have to deal with in writing about real people. And although not just the legalities, she also talked about the personal aspects when you're writing about family.
Family and friends,
you know, how to handle it, which she does extensively. She's the author of Motherless Daughters and Motherless Mothers. And she lost her mother quite early in her life and was raised, she and her siblings, were raised by their father. And when she published the book, she talked about how she knew that there was almost no way that it wasn't going to hurt her father. But she did have him, she asked him to read it before it went into final proofs, but it was at a stage where she couldn't have changed much. She could change for accuracy, but she couldn't have, like, taken a whole chapter out or something. And so she asked him to read it, and he replied with one inaccuracy about a fur coat.
A gift.
Yeah, that it had been a gift from him to her mother, not from somebody else. And and so she changed that. And when she went ahead and published, she knew that he was unhappy at first because he felt it made him look bad. But in fact, he got a lot of support and sympathy from people reading it.
Oh.
You know, like, wow, you know, look what you had to go through raising these kids on your own. And when he realized that, she said he became her number one fan and went down to the local Barnes & Noble and made him display it in the window. So that was nice to hear. But she obviously takes a lot of care. She said with her siblings, too, that she always lets them read anything that's written about them before it's published so that if they're so that they have some input into it.
So how many different lecturers did you have?
Well, there were five. There were four.
Oh, four.
And then
the
last day.
Yeah, the last day.
Yeah, which was really fun.
Wonderful.
I wouldn't mind going back up there for one of those again. Of course, there's only 1 week left of this year.
Yeah.
But, the faculty reading each, like about eight or nine or
starts ten. It must start pretty soon, about the middle of June then, or? If it's 6 weeks?
It starts in early June. They skip the week of July 4th.
Oh, sure.
Yeah, so they have 3 weeks in June and 3 weeks in July. Yeah.
And one of the faculty, let's see, what is her name? She wrote from a nonfiction piece based on beauty.
Oh, Linda Bendorf.
Beauty. Linda Bendorf.
Yes.
And it was very poignant and very funny and took you just, you know, unexpectedly. So I recommend that people try to get online and check some of these things out. And the other person who read on Wednesday was Carl Klaus, days into Daybook's A Voice for All Season, and he, I believe, was, yes, founding director of the University of Iowa Nonfiction Writing Program, and he had retired. I don't know how much we want to talk about what he spoke about.
Well, it was really, he was reading a piece of a book that he's working on, a nonfiction book that he's working on, which is based on how he developed his voice as a writer. He started a writing project, I can't remember what year it was. It was in the 1990s, I believe, where he was going to keep a day book and write an entry every day.
And literally a weather report.
A 500...
Carolyn just rolled her eyes. Like, how could that be?
A 500-word essay on the weather. And as he got into it, he quickly found that that he got much more personal, and his wife became ill during
right.
that time. And,
prior to that, he realized how automatic he was getting and how he really was distancing himself a bit too much.
Uh-huh.
And, yeah, he had this personal crisis, and he just started deepening his voice. And
by the time the year was over, he had a book, you know, from these daily essays that he wrote. And his reading was incredible.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that one, I believe, is also on the podcast.
Yeah.
Is on
several women around us were choked up and crying.
Did you bring a piece that you worked on to read to us today? Because we're down to like the last 10, 12 minutes.
All right. Well, this
Plenty
is
of time.
From one of the writing exercises, and I enjoyed this one very much because it was unexpected that it would come out of me and that it would come out the way it did. And my teacher passed around to each person a different color of a name, you know, named on a slip of paper, and the instruction is just meditate on that color for 20 minutes. And I got the color rose. So just give me a heads up if we're starting to run out of time, because this is a little long. Rose is subtle, not like her dominant spectral cousin blues, greens, and browns. She stays a safe distance from fire engine red. She can hide the skies in the littlest tufts at the heart of an artichoke. Rose can be rare and refined or deeply expressive on a ballroom wall. Rose thrives heartily in Bulgaria, speaking the language as she presses perfume onto the arms of the folk dancers. If you can't find Rose in America, tease her out with a dab of purest red blood, if truth be told. Add the white silk of lily and blend with a small wooden Breyers ice cream cup stick. You'll feel pink, but don't stop there. Tear a piece of yellow skin from the fruit of a peach and mix in a little dark brown beer for solemnity. You'll have Rose ready to serve. Rose wafts off an amber mirror at night, slides from a surfboard lip by day, pedals her way into the heart of a bicycle built for two chambers. Rose drops onto the toes of forgotten women and answers to the call of little girls. Rose never shocks, as our grandmothers knew, subduing sex with deeper shades and bringing out loyalty. Rose follows female saints to the hearts of their supplicants and drives life into the veins of romantic warriors. Rose dances with princes and flutters in the crinoline folds of the plum fairy. Rose goes home with a coachman. An antebellum southern rose is courted by bourbon. A court of roses attends to all servants. Rose naturally frequents weddings and sometimes sits in on the aftermath of revolutions. Rose sleeps at dawn, gains strength by day, and joins the sky sunset brigade, bringing up the rear, spraying pigment of watermelon against broad turquoise banners. Then Rose dips and scoots in for the action as snow bows. Where you won't find Rose? In volcanic rock, rolling in the hay, mounting a haystack, or in a cornfield, cackling with crows or consorting with criminals, in cobalt train streaks or on Superman's suit, in a coal mine or a nuclear plant.
Wow. Thank you, Hillary.
What did your fellow students think of that?
They really enjoyed it.
I can see why.
Oh,
yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Well, one of the things that in our class, we didn't actually do any writing exercises. We didn't actually do any writing during the week, but because we were critiquing existing manuscripts, we had to read everybody else's 18-page manuscript and critique it. But we did use, he did also use examples of other writing as to point out things that we, to learn. And Wayne Johnson was the name of the instructor. One of his favorite topics was beat structure, which he has a lot of experience in script writing in Hollywood too. And so this is, I think, maybe a concept that originated out there. And beat structure is the idea that in dialogue, you have a back and forth. You have an action and a reaction. And that anything that doesn't further that isn't action-reaction, is unnecessary. Mm-hmm. And you strip it out of the dialogue for the most powerful impact. So, like, here was an example of a dialogue that he gave us and how you change it so that it meets the parameters of beat structure. So we have a parking lot in front of a Denny's in Missouri. A man in overall stands watching the entrance. A car pulls into the lot, and a second man in a three-piece suit, Ed, gets out. First man was Sam. Ed, hey there, Sam. Sam, hey there. Ed, where's Louise? I thought she was coming. Sam, she's back at the house. Had too much to do. Ed, like what too much? I mean, you'd think. Sam, I don't care what you think. Ed, so what are you doing here? Sam, just wanted to set things straight. Ed, you want to do it inside or outside? Sam, outside's fine. Ed, nice weather for it. Okay, this is the dialogue that was started with. This is what it would sound like after you cut the unnecessary parts and just leave the beats. Ed, where's Louise? Sam, she's back at the house. Ed, so what are you doing here? Sam, just wanted to set things straight. Ed, you want to do it inside or outside?
Ah. Yeah.
And we had a whole series of those, and it was really interesting to see
trim it down
how much you can cut and how much more powerful it
exactly.
is.
Exactly.
Yes. That's called muscle. They refer to that a lot.
Muscle
in.
Oh.
Yeah. And really what it does is it makes the reader infer more from the piece. So there's more suspense. And it doesn't just wash away by the time you get to the inside or outside.
So writing dialogue is really fun, but a very important part of fiction writing and a very important part of characterization in fiction writing.
Well, characterization is something that I used to have trouble with. I'd get the characters kind of miscombobulated sometimes. But I never wrote a novel. I have an idea for a novel, but I've never written it. But I've got notes, notes.
Really?
Yeah.
What's
yeah.
it about?
Well, it's about this. This actually happened. There was a young boy taken from outside a store in the East. The father was in the service. The mother was in the store with an older child, and this baby was taken. And then, so my story is what happened to him. He was taken by a woman who desperately wanted a child, and she wasn't going to hurt him, but she was very wealthy, and she didn't have any children. She raised him in South America. Well, then she dies, and he finds out that what happened from one of her confidants, and then he goes looking for his family.
And that sounds like a good premise.
Yeah. So yeah, I thought it was.
Yeah.
So
definitely,
he finds that his family fell apart. His mother and father divorced, and his father's family blamed her, of course, and
for leaving him in the car.
Right. Yeah. But they had moved back to Iowa, and so it was.
Well, we barely got started.
That's the way it is when you have so much to say.
I know. And I do have to highly recommend this.
I was just going to ask you that. If you recommend this experience to beginners, intermediate, experienced writers, everybody.
They have classes for all levels. Mm-hmm. And I recommend the one that I took, the instructor that I took, if you really want to learn the techniques of fiction. Mm-hmm. I mean, I didn't even get into some of the other things that we talked about. Tone, plot strands, framing a story, episodic versus linear chronology, all kinds of things. And it definitely inspired me to go back and rework things that I've written to improve them, knowing this.
Knowing that, some more techniques. Did you did you have homework?
My homework was...
I did every day.
Did
was,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, mine was reading and critiquing other the other
okay.
manuscripts.
That kept you focused then on what on the whole thing?
The whole program was very, very focused, but gave you time to write. I mean, it was structured so that you could join the group in the morning if you wanted to write and meet and talk. You go to your 11s at 11 o'clock in this wonderful auditorium. From noon to 2, you're free to have lunch and do whatever. 2 to 5, you met in your classrooms. And I think 3 or 4 of the nights were scheduled. You know, we had a big banquet the last night and the cheese and wine party and...
Right, and then the other nights there were readings at Prairie Light.
There was open mic.
Right.
So it's a full, very full week.
And you get an individual conference with your instructor also.
Yeah.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Oh, great.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, the class is small enough that you can do that.
Right, right.
Yeah, that was good. I'm glad you had a good experience.
So next year, Mom, you think it'll be your turn?
I don't know. That's a possibility.
Well, if you're listening to us on Friday, I want to encourage you to stay tuned for James Moore, Planet Erstwhile. He has some wonderful interviews this afternoon. Major General Scott Gration, who was here speaking about Obama's plan to end the Iraq War, and BBC filmmaker Stuart Tanner is back on the air with Planet Erstwhile again this afternoon from, I believe,
good.
From England. And if you're listening to us on the repeat Monday morning from 8 to 9, please stay tuned for Steve Colt and The Colt Show. And we will close with Mom's quote.
Okay, this is a silly one, but be a leader. Remember, the lead sled dog is the only one with a decent view. Have a nice day.
And see you next week.
Writers' Voices is hosted, produced, and engineered by Monica Hadley, Caroline Kilborn, and Shemaine Montana. Archives available at KRUUFM.com and WritersVoices.com. Writers Voices is a production of KRUULP 100.1 FM, broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield, Iowa.